dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as, well, an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man whose grasp of the nature of the war for the free world I've come to admire greatly is our first guest. His name is Representative Paul Gosar. He is a dentist by training, but he has been serving now for six terms in the United States Congress, representing with distinction the people of the 4th Congressional District of Arizona. He serves on the Natural Resources and Oversight and Reform Committees in the House of Representatives. He is the ranking member of the House Oversight and Reform Committee's Subcommittee on Oversight and Investigations, and consequently a man who has considerable insight as well as oversight on several things that we're anxious to talk with him about. Congressman Gosar is a good friend of mine, and I'm always delighted to have a chance to visit with him. Sir, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. It's great to have you with us.
Thank you, Frank. Always great to hear from you.
Thank you. Let me talk to you first and foremost about something that I know has been very much a focus of your activity, particularly this week, Congressman, and that is the events of the 6th of January and what has flowed from them. Let me start by just asking the most pointed of questions. Do you think, based on everything we've learned so far, that this was, as it is relentlessly characterized, an insurrection?
Well, Frank, there was a lot of concern across America in regards to the election and the fairness of the election and whether it was actually stolen. And this was a movement that tried to petition utilizing their First Amendment right to come forward, to petition the government to speak up and to ask questions, you know, and to get some answers. And I think that for the most part, everybody was a good actor that came in good faith. But I think it was co-opted. And by whom, I don't know. But that's why I constantly have petitioned to get the 14,000 hours of videotape out there so that we can actually discern who are the actors that were violating the law, who are the ones that were provocating problems with the Capitol Police and the folks protecting the premises, and then adjudicating the people that were innocent, letting them go go back home. You know, that's what's so problematic here is that they're not willing to do that. You know, we've gone to the DOJ. I've sent numerous letters to get more information, to get this tapes released. I've got no reply. And several of my colleagues and myself went to the DOJ to ask the questions. You know, have you gotten our information? Do you plan to give us that information so that the American public can be separated? As well as the people that have been incarcerated and charged, they have the right to materials to defend themselves. And we're not seeing that. And we actually went to the jail yesterday. Once again, treated very poorly. If they treat members of Congress that poorly, I can only wonder what is happening to those in the jail cells who have not been charged, who have been sometimes, from what we understand, put in 23-hour isolation.
Solitary confinement, to be precise,
yeah,
right?
And treated poorly. So, you know, there's a lot of questions here. And those people need to be held accountable that took a movement belonged to within our Constitution.
Finish that thought, if you would, because this is really getting to the nub of the issue of are we likely to get truth out of this commission, as is ostensibly being promised.
It's not, because when you look at it, the ultimate person responsible for this security and foresight was none other than Nancy Pelosi. So, you know, there's now information that they may have known quite a while before this that there was problems coming. Maybe there were some actors outside of of this country. You know, there's a lot of questions here, Frank, that have to get answered.
But does the structure of this committee and its membership give you much confidence that you're going to find out whether Nancy Pelosi, perhaps by action or inaction, enabled the events of the 6th of January to play out as they did with, as you know better than anybody, Congressman, because you were one of the objectors, as I recall, the effect being to disrupt what was hoped for by Donald Trump and most of the people outside of the Capitol that day and down on the Mall, as I was down on the Mall, you know, for a process to be undertaken by the Congress that would enable questionable credentialing of electors to be challenged.
Right. Well, you know, the minority leader put up five different individuals. Two of them were rejected, Mr. Representative Banks from Indiana and Mr. Jordan from Ohio. And, you know, this was unprecedented that a speaker would say no to the privilege of the minority party or even, you know, the opposite party. It doesn't matter which. This is unprecedented. And you can't, that can't be done. And these are two gentlemen that have the protocol, you know, pretty good credentials and asking some pretty tough questions. So this is a
and then she went so far as to select two people, at least nominally, on the Republican side of the aisle, Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger, to represent Republicans without the permission of the minority leader. And that would also be rather unprecedented, I believe, would it not?
It is. And that's why, you know, the conference, the Republican conference, has looked at, you know, that accepting those positions is really a detriment to their being part of the Republican caucus. And if future, you know, continuation within the Republican Party should not continue. You know, it's traitorous, to be honest with you, in regards to the caucus. Now, they may say, listen, they're love of their country. That's not the case. It was about the hatred that they had for Donald Trump superseded their love and commitment to this country. And so it's a partisan hack commission. And, you know, we've already got two reports from the Senate that shows that there were security lapses in even the application. They should have known better. You had an inauguration coming. You knew people were coming because of the innuendos to hotels and other things in the area saying, put it out to these people coming for at this time frame. So this was a debacle from the very get-go in regards to, you know, the buildup of natural protections in regards to the security forces. They turned down over 100 additional security, Capitol Police. You know, you had the president seeing the massive crowds saying, listen, you know, we got the National Guard. They could be utilized. And they really didn't. And so, you know, we need to get to the bottom of this, because this would have never happened if the proper protocols, the proper force was in place and dictating the process all the way across the board, Brian.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more that we've got to get to the bottom of it. And I also think we've heard strong agreement that it's unlikely to be done by this commission as it stands now. I hope that the Republicans will undertake their own independent commission and that you and others who have been so courageous in taking up with the Department of Justice and the D.C. jail this past week, the travesties that have, as I say, flowed from the initial, debacle is, I guess, one word for it. I think if it was, in fact, a provocation, it may have been a pretty skillful one under the circumstances. It certainly had a very predictable effect, as I say, especially on that deliberative process that was supposed to go on in the course of the 6th of January. Congressman.
Absolutely. And that's why we continue to pursue and want your listeners to ask for the same thing, the 14,000 hours of tape, videotapes, so that we can hold these provocateurs who created the problem, hold them accountable. You know, these could be foreign actors. We don't know. That's the whole case is that under the rule of law, citizens, people have due process here. And in order to have due process, you have to have access to exculpatory information. and data to allow to a defense and to find out, you know, who actually did it and how it was done and how it was conceived and implemented.
Well, and in particular, to get justice for these individuals who seem to be being treated more like political prisoners, honestly, than individuals who were, you know, involved in some sort of insurrectionist activity. Let me turn to two other things with you quickly, Congressman Paul Gosar, because I want to make sure we get your thoughts on other priorities, I think, for hopefully those of you overseeing our government. One is the China threat, Congressman. We're seeing evidence in public polling that large majorities of Americans are now really concerned about what the Chinese are doing, including some 81% in a recent Trafalgar poll indicating concern about what the Chinese are doing in our own country, in the way of influence in our government and in our media and in our culture. By the way, in that number, 50%+ felt highly concerned about what the Chinese are up to. I wonder if you would just comment on that in general, as you look at it from sort of the position of someone overseeing particularly what's going on in our government. Are we recognizing the efforts the Chinese are making to influence and really subvert us from within?
I think we're doing a very poor job. When you look at the 60,000 foot level, you know, things that we're dependent upon, whether it be rare earths and minerals, things like pharmaceuticals, we have now seen our real soft belly of exposure here, that we don't have the supply chains that are necessary. We don't have the materials that actually are important to technology and new advancements, and whether it be the military application to new technology, to space and satellites, to even our farmland. We're seeing the Chinese gobbling up farmland. This is critical because, you know, food production is to national security issues. And mining is also the security issue. Energy is another security issue. And they know that the Chinese do not have the best intentions in mind. They know for a fact that, you know, they are about domination. And constantly we see the intrusion, whether it be, you know, members of Congress that they tried to exploit, members all the way down to city mayors, to county supervisors. The influence and peddling up here with China is huge. It's huge.
If I may, Congressman Gosar, as you know, one of your colleagues on the Democratic side of the aisle, Eric Swalwell from California, a member of the House Intelligence Committee, has acknowledged having a relationship with a Chinese spy by the name of Fang Fang. There is a report that the intelligence community has evidently generated. It's a little unclear exactly what its content is, but we assume that it is a damage assessment of what has been the result of having a member of the intelligence committee compromised in this fashion. Professionals in the business have shared with me the very real concern that he may still be being handled by a, you know, Ministry of State security operation. And therefore, his continued presence, not just presence on the committee, sir, but his presence as the chairman of the Intelligence Modernization and Readiness Subcommittee of the House Intelligence Committee could be a very serious national security problem. Is that something that your committee could be providing a second opinion on? And in any event, do you agree that Nancy Pelosi should remove Eric Swalwell from the Intelligence Committee forthwith?
I think he's a compromised asset, and I'm not alone. I think the majority of Republicans would say the very thing, that if it was a Republican in that situation, Frank, they're long gone, and they're probably not even a member of Congress. You know, but that shows you the two different venues in regards to jurisdiction and justice that is applied unevenly with this speaker to members of her party.
It's outrageous, truly.
You cannot be beholden to these foreign governments. I mean, this is sad, but it shows you the infiltration that China has gone through, because they got to him way before he was in Congress.
They brought him to Congress, I would argue.
It appears that it extended and gotten much deeper.
Yes, indeed. Well, we hope that you will help call for his removal from this committee, sir, if we can, because this is a matter of, I believe, very considerable national security import. Let me turn to one last thing. As I mentioned, sir, you are a dentist, therefore a member of the medical community. I'm particularly interested in your thoughts about the vaccine mandates that are now being increasingly bruited by the president and his team, including compulsory vaccination of federal employees, military personnel, not just healthcare folks, but all of them. And this idea that we may well see emerge from all of it, something that has been described as vaccine passports. What are your thoughts on all of this?
Well, this is an arena that the government cannot go and should not go. You know, there's this thing called your Bill of Rights and your freedoms, and it is fine to allow people to make that choice. But there's also the epidemiology in regards to natural born immunization. And that is that for people that contact COVID, like myself, have the antibodies. That's nature's natural ability to combat diseases and viruses. And that builds up to herd immunity. So many people, that have taken the immunizations, they were told that this would basically make it, if they did get the contact with the virus again, much less severe. But that's a personal choice. And if you've got the vaccine, then you're probably in better shape, and there's no guarantees, but you're better off. Those that are not vaccinated, they're taking that risk as well. But how can you just discern natural immunization with the antibodies versus man-made vaccine? They work. But I think it's for everybody to have a choice, and for the government to mandate that, or to have citizens going door to door, is actually a disgusting disregard for the Constitution, the rule of law, and our personal rights and liberties.
Amen. And I hope you would agree that the idea of essentially putting into place something that I fear would inevitably evolve into something akin to the Chinese social credit system by having vaccine passports that can be used to essentially aggregate all kinds of information about individuals, not just their vaccination status, is also an affront to our Constitution and must be resisted as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Americans are, the freedoms and liberties and the encroachment on them by our government. And its use of corporations and businesses to do their work is a step closer to tyranny and to authoritarianism, and we got to resist that. What did Ronald Reagan say? When there's an injustice, we got to stop. When a law is broken, we got to stop holding society accountable. We need to hold the lawbreaker accountable.
As on so many other things, he hit it exactly right. Congressman Paul Gosar, thanks for what you get right on so many of these issues. We really appreciate what you do, sir, and the chance to visit with you. And we look forward to talking with you over the weekend on our television program, Securing America. Join us there at Real America's Voice. Thank you very much for joining us, sir. We'll be right back with you soon. Paul, we're going to talk with Ben Weingarten about all of this and more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Donald Trump famously promised that with him as president, Americans would, quote, get tired of winning, unquote. It appears that they are increasingly getting tired of losing under his successor. A recent YouGov Economist poll, weighted significantly in Democrats' favor, found that a majority of those surveyed believe the nation is on the wrong track. And why not? Americans are losing income to inflation. They're losing confidence in public health authorities, the security of our border, what's taught in our schools, and the guarantees of our constitutional rights. Then there's our country losing ground to communist China, the Taliban, narco-traffickers, gangs, and other criminals. In short, the public seems to be responding to what increasingly can best be described as a Biden-Harris wrecking operation that is having its desired and ominous effect, namely fundamentally transforming America. Are you tired of losing your country yet? This is Frank Gaffney.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and a special welcome to our next guest, one of my favorites to have here on Secure Freedom Radio, and we need to do more of it, frankly, if we can persuade him to join us more regularly. His name is Benjamin Weingarten. He is a senior contributor at The Federalist, a columnist at Newsweek, and a fellow at the Claremont Institute. He's the author of a terrific book, American Ingrate, about Ilhan Omar. We'll be speaking with him about her momentarily. You can find his work at benweingarten.com and follow him, as I do, at BH Weingarten on Twitter. Ben, it's good to have you back in the house virtually. Welcome.
Frank, thanks as always for that most kind introduction. Really appreciate it.
Well, it's deserved in this case. Let me ask you to introduce our audience, if you would, to a powerful piece that you had at the Epoch Times last week, I believe, entitled "The Ruling Class Poses the Very Authoritarian Dangers It Claimed Trump Did." Walk us through that. Who, first of all, is the ruling class, as you see it, and what are the sorts of authoritarian dangers they're up to?
Well, I never thought that I would be using a phrase like the ruling class. It sort of grated on me in the past. The ruling class is essentially a collection at the commanding heights of society that, in order to protect its power and privilege, has to do everything it can to neutralize purported threats, really, to its power and privilege, but which it claims threaten America writ large. And of course, Donald Trump was perceived as the greatest threat to the power and privilege of the ruling class. There were all sorts of accusations leveled at him that were really kind of a sideshow from the real fact that he challenged their agenda, and he represented tens of millions of Americans in doing so. And I think everything that we've seen during the 4 years of President Trump and then subsequently with respect to the attempt to paint roughly half the country now as potential insurrectionists, domestic violent extremists, so-called, and worse, to cast them as bigoted, to claim they pose a public health risk and beyond, is all about the ruling class trying to destroy or at least silence and chill dissenting opinion in this country. And I held up in this piece Mark Milley, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and he's sort of a proxy for many of those in the political establishment and beyond who have these hyperbolic statements. And really, in his case, I think basically violates code and also just best practices and beyond, to say the least, with respect to the type of rhetoric that we see and sort of representing the kind of woke, unhinged insubordinates that tried to stifle the Trump presidency. And it continues on and on to today. And it should scare and chill the American people that these are the people in power, those who are willing to do everything they can to essentially stifle and stymie those who represent the governed, those who we've given the consent. These are unelected bureaucrats in many cases who are completely abrogating that sacred pact. And it threatens really self-rule in this country, self-government in this country, and a sovereign people.
On General Milley, I think it's particularly important what you've highlighted in this piece, Ben Weingarten, to see his role in what seems to be the sort of Marxist march through the institution of the United States military now, part of that long march through the institutions of which we've heard so much for so long, but now has reached the Pentagon and the armed services. When you look at what Milley is doing, what Lloyd Austin, the Secretary of Defense, is doing, what this special assistant for, I think it's diversity, Bishop Garrison, is doing with his encountering extremism working group, populated by the likes of the Southern Poverty Law Center and the Muslim Brotherhood, for heaven's sakes. It really raises profound questions, not just about sort of our society or our culture, but actually our national security as well, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And look, the national security and law enforcement apparatuses, and I guess public health too, we can add to this as well, are those areas that must be insulated from politics, must truly be independent and serve their masters, namely the commander in chief, who is a representative of the American people. And because literally life and limb depends on not only not being politically incorrect or woke, but in confronting our worst adversaries forthrightly, clearly, soberly, and beyond. And what we see instead is the same corrosive, woke, anti-cultural march through the institutions taking place across every institution, including those that concern American life of limb, with disastrous ramifications for morale, for fitness, for readiness, and also in the eyes of our adversaries, making us look like a weak mark to be easily taken on. And you know, I talk about in this piece, General Milley talking about white rage. Does he think understanding white rage is part of his job description? Apparently so. And then I also discuss the fact that he and many others cast Trump as an authoritarian, a fascist, etc. But meanwhile, who has been attempting to rule by fiat over the last year plus, controlling speech under the guise of health and public safety via big tech and beyond, seeking to manipulate 2020 election laws? All things done not by President Trump, but by his opposition over the last year plus, and all things that if people were looking at this objectively would say, look at all the ways they exploited the coronavirus to usurp maximum power. Who's done that? The ruling class, not the purported authoritarian fascist threat. And that's just for starters.
That is just for starters. Hey, Ben, before we run out of time, let me switch gears and turn to a member of, well, I guess you would call the ruling class now, Congresswoman Ilhan Omar, who you feature prominently in your book, American Ingrate, as I mentioned. She is, at the moment, leading an effort, now joined by 24 of her colleagues, all Democrats on Capitol Hill, demanding that Tony Blinken, the Secretary of State, create the post of a special envoy to counter Islamophobia, as she calls it, internationally and presumably here at home. You followed her closely. You know her priorities and proclivities. Talk a little bit about the Islamophobia, smear, for want of a better term, as it applies to people who are simply pointing out some of the real threats arising from the Islamic doctrine of Sharia, and how it potentially would be used by individuals who have that agenda, or groups for that matter, the Muslim Brotherhood notably among them, to suppress our freedom of speech or otherwise undermine our friends.
Yeah, well, in the book American Ingrate, I talk about Islamophobia and sort of its derivation, its origins, and how it's been used essentially to try and smear and chill any speech that really dares to delve into the threat doctrine of Islamic supremacists, to look again forthrightly, soberly, objectively at Islamic doctrine, and then how jihadists themselves, both violent and nonviolent, use that doctrine to justify, essentially to create their entire game plan, to telegraph their game plan, their strategy and tactics, to ultimately lord over the world and subject the world to Islamic rule. So Islamophobia is raised as a cudgel and wielded against anyone who would dare actually look at it with clear and open eyes. And it's meant to, just like claims of bigotry on any of a number of issues that the left uses, for example, like vote integrity laws, to silence, smear, target, and opposition. And that's just for starters, not even getting into the fact that you could look at Islamic doctrine as justifying calls to stop, to halt, to censor any speech that would dare get in the way of the Islamic supremacist goals, tactics, and strategies. Relatedly to that, and the really critical point that you sort of imply in your question is this part of something broader, a broader anti-free speech push? And of course, as your listeners probably know, the OIC and other Islamic organizations have sought to use Islamophobia to actually implement anti-speech statutes, or at least resolutions, in international venues and then in European countries as well, to try to halt any speech essentially that Islamists don't like. And so the elevation or creation of an envoy, which on the merits I think is unjustifiable, and we could go into the statistics about anti-Muslim hate crimes and the like, but even leaving all of that aside, the idea of elevating it to essentially, first of all, put Islamophobia on the level of anti-Semitism, which I think is definitely an aspect of this. But the other part is, by elevating it to an envoy position, it should be seen as part of this much broader global push to create the narrative of Islamophobia as a scourge of the West, and consequently to implement all sorts of speech codes, de facto or de jure, which of course ultimately aid, abet, and enable exactly what the Islamic supremacists want, which is to silence anyone who would dare look clearly at what's going on.
Yeah, that's so well said, Ben. And I would just add to that rendering of what their agenda was that, of course, then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton promised to use old-fashioned techniques of shaming and peer pressure to try to accomplish a similar kind of suppression of freedom of speech here in our own country. So your expertise on this is really appreciated, Ben. Quickly and lastly, arguably, if there is any such thing as Islamophobia, truly, it obviously is being practiced on a massive scale by communist China. And I'm really struck, Ben, that none of the groups that are so hot about Islamophobia, including, I think, Ilhan Omar, have taken the Chinese to task very much over what they're doing in the way of genocide, for heaven's sakes, against Muslims in the Uyghur population in Western China. Quickly, any thoughts on that?
It illustrates the disingenuous of the charge that, of course, the pluralistic and tolerant liberal West gets cast as Islamophobic, while you literally have the gulagging of Muslims en masse, over a million potentially at least that we know about within China's borders. And it's in Xinjiang, which of course is a hugely strategically significant area that the Belt and Road will run through and does run through to a large extent. And I think what it shows is how hollow the cries of Islamophobia are from powers in the Islamic world, and that ultimately it comes down to the strong horse gets to dictate what transpires, and they view China as an ascendant strong horse, and consequently they are deathly afraid of daring to call China out for its savage acts.
Yeah, that's clearly part of it. And the other part of it, I think, is they've been bought by China to be silent, notably Recep Tayyip Erdogan of Turkey and his regime there. It's a pretty cynical bit of business, and I think it's important to both be standing up for those who are being so egregiously persecuted and indeed murdered by the Chinese Communist Party for their Muslim faith, among other things, as well as to criticize those who are obviously, at best, very cynical and at worst, downright deceitful when it comes to arguing that there's this terrible curse of Islamophobia in the world, and they turn a blind eye to what's happening to the Uyghurs. Ben Weingarten, so much more to talk with you about. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. This is a topic, both of these are very important topics to us, and we appreciate your clarity and leadership on them. And we look forward to visiting with you in the near future. In the meantime, stay well, my friend. Have a good weekend. Next up, we'll speak with another wonderfully impressive rising young star in the journalistic trade, Natalie Winters of the National Pulse. We'll talk with her about China and what it's doing inside the United States and more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back, and a very special and heartfelt welcome to our next guest. Her name is Natalie Winters. She is a brilliant and extraordinarily young investigative reporter for a terrific, relatively new online resource, the National Pulse. Her boss, Rahim Kassam and Natalie have been doing incredible work, notably with their podcast, but also at thenationalpulse.com. And you can follow Natalie, which I strongly encourage you to do, as I do, at Natalie G. Winters. Natalie Winters, it is wonderful to have you back and to have a chance to visit with you about just a couple of the incredibly important stories that you have been breaking and relentlessly pursuing in a fashion that I think would be, you know, the envy of most people in the investigative journalism trade, if there were one any longer. So you are one of the few remaining examples of what it really is all about. And I can't tell you how much we appreciate the work you do at the National Pulse for joining us to talk about it.
Well, thank you so much for having me and having me back. And you always give the best introduction.
Well,
so thank you for that as
you
well.
You earn them. You earn them. So, Natalie, let's talk about two of your ongoing focuses. Both have to do, actually, with the Chinese Communist Party and what it is up to. Let's start with influence operations. As I mentioned in my conversation earlier in the program with Congressman Gosar, the American people are exhibiting a lot of unease, some 81% of them in a recent poll, about Chinese influence in our government, in our media, and in our culture. And I think particularly, Natalie, the work you've done exposing a number of the political appointees of the Biden administration, well, one could start with the president himself, who are compromised by the Chinese Communist Party, is incalculably important. Let's spend a few minutes just talking about one in particular, a fellow by the name of Thomas Zimmerman. Who is he and what is he doing and what are the implications of it?
Sure. So Thomas Zimmerman is essentially running the hiring process over at the Presidential Personnel Office for National Security Agency personnel, which is a very, very concerning problem because Thomas Zimmerman also has links to the Chinese Communist Party. You mentioned that interesting study, I believe it was from the Trafalgar Group, that came out where it showed that 81% of people are concerned about Chinese Communist Party influence. And when I first saw that poll, I thought, wow, maybe the National Pulse's work is cutting through. I think this is good. You know, a lot of the American people understand the risks and really the extent of Chinese Communist Party influence. But if you think about it, that's also an outstanding 19% of people who are either okay or think that Chinese Communist Party infiltration is not at a level in which they are scared of. And I think that that 19% of people really is epitomized by people like Thomas Zimmerman and, frankly, more broadly, the Biden family, i.e. people who are part of kind of the D.C. political class, part of the American establishment, people who've worked in the D.C. think tank orbit, people who've, you know, worked on the Hill. And they've benefited.
Then Weingarten just called them the ruling class as another way of describing what they're up to. Yeah. So you've got this guy at the White House who is making recommendations as to who should be appointed to presidential appointees in the national security agencies. And what exactly is his tie to the Chinese Communist Party?
Sure. So he formerly served as a fellow at the Shanghai Academy of Social Sciences. And while just at first glance, you might be able to tell that that is, of course, a state-run think tank, which, you know, pumps out anti-American propaganda and has a host of even military-linked researchers on staff. But what's particularly unique and really egregious about this institute is that it's actually been flagged by the FBI as having links to not only the Ministry of State Security, but really playing an active role in the Chinese Communist Party's overseas influence campaigns. Particularly, there was a case, and I believe it was 2019, where an American operative who used to work at the CIA, his name was Kevin Mallory, had been contacted by officials from this same think tank that Thomas Zimmerman was working as a fellow at. And they were basically trying to coax him and get him into selling over for, I'm sure, a very pretty penny, top secret and classified documents from either the CIA or various federal agencies within the United States government. So this is a think tank.
Well,
that
in
is
fact,
not
they succeeded in doing it. That guy's rotting in jail for having actually served as a spy for the Chinese Communist Party, recruited through this Shanghai Academy. And so it's not an abstraction. It's not just a possibility. I believe, Natalie, as your reporting has indicated, the FBI is warning that this is a facility used for this kind of purpose. And to have a guy who's coming out of it making presidential appointments in the national security space of the United States is just unbelievable. And unfortunately, it's just one example that that you've been documenting at your incredibly important post at the National Pulse. Let me ask you about another angle of all of this that you've been reporting on lately, including today, I believe, Natalie, and that is the degree to which American legislators are also being caught up in Chinese influence operations in a very lucrative way, perhaps.
Sure. So, you know, there's been a lot of talk about how America has really underwritten the rise of the Chinese Communist Party. And there are a lot of ways that American elites have done that, whether by, you know, outsourcing factories, letting them join the World Trade Organization, you know, the list goes on. But one particularly, I think just, I mean, it's just crazy. And I think really metaphorically deep way that you see how really DC, but precisely the Democratic Party has enabled the rise of the Chinese Communist Party is that we've identified at least three, and believe me, there are more coming, but elected officials, senators and congressmen who are actively invested in Chinese Communist Party, both linked and owned companies. One person in particular, might I add that all three individuals, you can go and see the stories at the National Pulse, they all hyped, you know, the Trump-Russia collusion conspiracies. Meanwhile, they have Chinese Communist Party run companies in their own portfolios, which is just a level of hypocrisy that I don't even think is DC level. But what is particularly interesting is Josh Gottheimer, who is dubbed by the New York Times as a Clinton prodigy. I think Chelsea Clinton even referred to him as like a member of the family. So someone who is, you know, a bigwig in Democratic politics. He's actually invested in China Mobile, which is flagged by the Department of Defense. The U.S. Department of Defense is having collaborated with the People's Liberation Army for over two decades. You also have Senator Tom Carper, who's really been spearheading the infrastructure charge of the Biden White House, and another individual, Peter Welch, who really was a hardcore advocate of a hardcore investigation into the Trump campaign's alleged ties to Russia and Vladimir Putin. They are also invested in various ETFs that if you look at the companies in the portfolio, they are all either Chinese Communist Party owned or operated. And I'd also posit that even allegedly privately owned companies in China are really just dormant state-owned enterprises, given Article 7 of the national security law.
Or not so dormant.
Broadly how the economy works.
On demand, they will serve the party, that's for sure. And in some cases, I think it's so, Natalie, that the senators and congressmen are investing in companies that have not only got ties to the Chinese Communist Party, and in some cases to the People's Liberation Army, but they've been sanctioned for those ties by the Biden administration itself, or the Trump administration before it, or both. These are the sorts of things that should be really very important red flags, if I can use that expression, for Americans who are rightly concerned about Chinese influence operations, and particularly inside our government. And by the way, for those, as you say, 19% that don't seem to be at the moment, heaven help us. Let me talk about somebody else who's been aiding and abetting the Chinese Communist Party, and you've done incredibly important work exposing the extent to which it's been done in the face of a lot of efforts, his own and others, to obscure his role. And I'm talking about, of course, Dr. Anthony Fauci. Talk a little bit about what you've learned in the course of your reporting and shared now with the rest of us about his activities in connection with the gain of function, as it's called, research at this Wuhan Institute of Virology and what it has unleashed on the world.
Sure. Well, it's funny. I woke up this morning and I was scrolling through Twitter, and one of the first things I saw was a cartoon from a Chinese state-run media outlet actually defending Fauci from Rand Paul. And I think that about tells you what you need to know with regards to Fauci and his allegiance. And the cartoon is specifically about gain of function research. And given all the other bizarre propaganda and talking point that these state-run outlets love to push, I think that tells you that Fauci's insistence that it wasn't gain of function research and that he wasn't funding it is also similarly untrue. And I think it's important for people to remember, because the first time that Rand Paul and Fauci went back and forth in the Senate, and even prior to that, when he was on mainstream media outlets, you know, the first narrative was, oh, well, we don't know the Wuhan Institute of Virology. We've never funded the Wuhan Institute of Virology. For lack of a better term, there was kind of a Chinese wall between the NIAID and the Wuhan Institute of Virology. Then, thanks to the great reporting of many outlets and even the questioning of Rand Paul, we see the story start to change. And it's, well, we were funding the Wuhan Institute of Virology, but it wasn't gain of function research. Then the latest iteration has become, well, it wasn't the dangerous type of gain of function research. But, you know, I will quote people who are smarter than me in the eyes of the scientific establishment. But the 2015 paper that the people are talking about, it was funded by the NIAID, and one of the key authors of it was Ralph Baric, which is a name that Rand Paul has brought up many times while questioning Anthony Fauci. And what's really interesting is that if you look at the scientific literature about this paper at the time of publication, particularly an article in the magazine Nature, which also happened to be the same journal that the study was published in, they admit that the study was gain of function research. And a quick quote in an article summarizing the findings, they say, the argument is essentially a rerun of the debate over whether to allow lab research that increases the virulence, ease of spread, or host range of dangerous pathogens, what is known as gain of function research. In other words, all of the scientists were up in arms. Some were in support of it, some weren't. But because this paper really re-inflamed and reinvigorated the debate over gain of function research, which the general takeaway from that is therefore that the research was gain of function. Also, the study did fall under the pause on gain of function research. The NIH eventually greenlit funding to continue to support this project. But lastly, and I'm aware this is a lot of information, but it's also very interesting because the author of this paper, Ralph Baric, did a podcast in 2015, about 2 weeks after the study came out. And I believe the podcast was called It's Not SARS 2.0, which is a title that has not aged very well. But you can hear him and his co-author on the study talking about not only how it's gain of function research, but also talking about how the NIH was very supportive of it. And that's a direct quote, very supportive. And I think that this just broadly demonstrates how the NIH, you know, didn't understand, or more frankly, maybe they did, because people like Fauci and Francis Collins seem to be okay collaborating with the Chinese government. We just pointed out that Francis Collins is actually on the board of a conference that's hosted by BGI Genomics, which is, of course, a Chinese military-linked genomics firm that steals and harvests data from millions of Americans. So I think that it's really just a reckless policy that these people who've headed these taxpayer-funded agencies for so long, they don't understand the evil and frankly, existential nature of the Chinese Communist Party and the threat that they pose to America. So that's why they were okay sending 6- and 7-figure taxpayer dollar sums overseas.
To aid and abet what is actually the Chinese Communist Party's biological warfare program. And to the point you just made, Natalie Winters, what is so alarming about what we've learned in the space of the time since this bioengineered disease emanated from that same Wuhan Institute of Virology, from the laboratory and researchers giving it the gain of function that has enabled it to become a threat to humans, and now murdered millions of them around the world and over 600,000 of them here. But to your other most immediate observation, Natalie, this biological warfare program, we have growing evidence, is intended to harm Americans in a much more comprehensive and genocidal way. In fact, the then Minister of Defense of China back in 2002-2003 timeframe told a secret meeting of party cadre about the initial intention of then General Secretary of the Chinese Communist Party, Deng Xiaoping, when he started this covert and illegal biological warfare program, namely to use it to wipe out the population of the United States so that this country could be repopulated by Chinese. These are the sorts of things that make what it appears Tony Fauci did, and your reporting on it has been just breathtakingly impressive, to enable the techniques to be taught to the Chinese, to give these kinds of diseases enhanced capabilities to afflict humans. And by the way, as you know, Natalie, Lawrence Sellin has talked about this as a problem not just in Wuhan or over there, but PLA officers and other scientists from China's biological warfare activities are training in our own country, even today. All of this gives rise to a danger that the blood on Fauci's hands from the COVID-19 virus may be just the beginning of the horrific consequences of this misplaced funding. Natalie, so much more to talk with you about, and I'm sorry for prattling on there, but this is the sort of thing that your work at the National Pulse has helped others of us understand better and hopefully will equip us to take constructive action to protect ourselves against, because heaven knows these people have not just world domination in the abstract in mind, but they have in mind taking us out in the process. Bless you for what you do, Natalie. I'm so appreciative of the chance to visit with you, and we're looking forward to having a chat, by the way, folks, as well with Natalie that'll air over the weekend in our television program, Securing America. But I hope you'll keep coming back to us frequently here at Securing, at both Secure Freedom Radio and Securing America. It's great to talk with you, Natalie, and thanks so much for all you do. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again on Monday, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Afte. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with a word about a truly great American patriot in urgent need. Rich Higgins served in the U.S. Army and as a key civilian Pentagon official and senior strategist on President Trump's National Security Council. After he left the NSC, Rich continued advising Mr. Trump and others about the threats we are facing from enemies, foreign and domestic. He chronicled his experiences over the past 20 years fighting for America First in a terrific memoir entitled The Memo. Now this courageous freedom fighter is gravely ill due to severe complications caused by the Chinese Communist Party virus. He urgently needs help to defray the enormous costs of successive surgeries and a prospective organ transplant. I urge you to join me in contributing to a GoFundMe campaign named Medical Help for Rich Higgins. That's Medical Help for Rich Higgins at GoFundMe.com. God bless you, and Rich Higgins.